Radio.
Song for the great show coming out of Cleveland, Ohio, American Sports History Podcast, produced by yours truly, Mark Mancini in Los Angeles, my brother, my mentor and friend, Peter Ray, out there in Cleveland, Ohio, 347-205-9631. If you happen to miss the show and you're sitting around a campfire with some friends in a kumbaya setting, catch it on blogtalkradio.com/Mancini Sports podcast platforms, wherever you subscribe to podcasts, powered now by Mancini Media. So without further ado, more of him, less of me. As I lay the red carpet down, put the podium in its place, hand off the mic, it's the threes, Peter. How are you? How can people get a hold of you? And you are bringing a legend in here today again, my friend.
Hi, Mark. I'm doing well. I have a YouTube channel. It's channel name is my name, Peter, J.R.E.A. We make history videos. I'd appreciate if people would subscribe. And you're absolutely right. Tonight's guest is the author of a new book that just came out in 2022, Weird Moments in Cleveland Sports, Bottlegate, Bedbugs, and Burying the Pennant and More. By, welcome to the show, Mr. Vince Guerrieri.
How you doing?
Good. So, Vince, could you give us? Could you tell us how you happened to write this book?
Well, this was actually my pandemic project. I'm active on social media. Probably my favorite is Twitter, and I have found a lot of like-minded lunatics when it comes to Cleveland sports. And we were talking about how there really seems to be an inordinate amount of strange events in Cleveland sports history. And there were enough that I was able to compile a list. And this was right before the world shut down 3 years ago, right around this time. And all of a sudden, we were very fortunate. We were able to keep working and stay healthy. But I had no sporting events to watch and lots of spare time. So, you know, I turned this into an outline. I turned it into a proposal, and Gray Publishing here in Cleveland bit, and the rest, as they say, is history.
Do you have now I've taken notes here. I've read the book, very much enjoyed it, highly recommend it. Is there any one story? If you're going to go through these stories, I thought maybe the best thing is you could go through your favorites. What's your favorite story among the stories that you told in the book? And then we can go through second, third, and fourth.
Sure, sure. Some of these stories ended up I write for a variety of publications. I work for a local newspaper in the Cleveland area, and I do some freelance stuff on the side. And a lot of the stories there are some stories that I was able to write about for other outlets that I ended up including in the book. I did a story for AHA magazine in 2015 on the first year of the Cleveland Cavs, and that was just a wealth of information. You know, there were just so many great stories of so many things that went wrong. There was a wrong-way basket scored during a game against the Portland Trailblazers. And the Cavs are so strange that when you talk about with the time they scored a wrong-way basket, you have to make the distinction of which one, because Ricky Davis did the same thing in the early aughts. He tried to he fired up a shot as the game waned, and he did so to get a rebound and get a triple-double. But there were a lot of stories at there are a lot of stories that, that came out of that 1970 Cavs team. And, you know, there was a story in the book as well about the Stratomatic All-Star Game, which is one of those things that I just stumbled upon, and I actually wrote about it for Deadspin. The Cleveland Stadium was supposed to host the All-Star Game in 1981. Major League Baseball players went on strike. And everybody said, geez, I don't know if they're going to be able to host the game. They ended up hosting the game when it came back, when baseball came back after the strike. It's still the only All-Star game that was on a weekend and the only All-Star game that was in August. But on the day that the All-Star game was supposed to be held, a couple of producers from the NBC affiliate here in Cleveland went into the stadium and played a Stratomatic baseball game on the field in front of a crowd of dozens, and they put on all the trappings of the game. Bob Feller came out to throw out the ceremonial first dice. Rocco Scotti, who's known to a generation of Cleveland fans for his performance of the national anthem, came and sang the national anthem backed by somebody playing the accordion, and it was just an absolute hoot. And it was one of those things, the reason that the All-Star game came about is because, like, nothing else is going on, and that was the same. I mean, nothing else was really going on, and it got national and even international coverage.
Jack from Solvang, California. I love the old Cleveland Cavaliers uniforms. Bingo Smith era also. The blood-soaked Indians, Cleveland Indians of the 1974 season. Any thoughts?
Yeah, that's, you know, it's kind of funny. He was talking about Bingo Smith. When I told the story about that wrong-way basket in 1970, I got to sit down with Bill Fitch, who was the coach of the Cavs, and he told me all about that. And he said, yeah, Bingo was I think it was John Warren that shot that wrong-way basket. And he said, yeah, we went into practice the next day, and Bingo was busting his chops, and then we watched the film, and you see Bingo in the corner waving for the ball so he could take a shot at the wrong basket too. And he said, and nobody said anything to him. But yeah, those 70s Indians uniforms, they were something. Those were the Crooked C's. The official name for the font, oddly enough, is Newland. And I learned this reading old Indians media guides, because that's my idea of a good time. But it was kind of amazing, because they had red, white, and blue, and they had red shirts and white shirts and blue shirts and red pants and white pants and blue pants, and they would mix and match. And I believe that was it was Boog Powell who said that in the all-red uniforms he looked like a giant blood clot.
Fran from Des Moines, Iowa, formerly of Youngstown, Ohio. When are the Cleveland Browns going to ever get to the Super Bowl? One of five teams, I believe, that's never seen the big game.
Actually, the Browns, I believe, are the only team that have never played in a Super Bowl or hosted a Super Bowl, because there are some teams out there like Jacksonville and the Detroit Lions that have also never played in a Super Bowl, but they have hosted the game. And to answer that question, man, I don't know. I have no earthly idea because, I mean, I don't feel like it's going to be this year. And I'm not sure it's going to be next year either.
Joey from Bucks County, Pennsylvania. The most famous Cleveland athlete has to be LeBron James.
Yeah, I'll cop to that. I mean, there were lots and lots of really famous Cleveland sports athletes, but I think that we live in an era where even if you don't know anything about basketball, you know who LeBron James is.
You had a story on Bill Veeck, I thought, where they buried the pennant, and I thought, you know, I think Bill Veeck, I think, is the greatest sports owner ever. And but I have to say that I think that idea of burying the pennant was a bad idea because, you know, the thing is, when you win a pennant or you win a World Series, it's forever. It's part of history. So, in a way, it's never lost. But anyway, I thought that was a – and it was funny how you get these other guys, they went along with it. They had Boudreaux. They're acting like it's a funeral. And you want to talk about Bill Veeck?
Yeah, yeah. Actually, I should have something in the hopper on Bill Veeck coming up in Defector about – when he owned the St. Louis Browns, which is he ended up selling the Indians after that 1949 season to actually to pay for his divorce. But he wasn't out of baseball for too long. But he bought the Indians in 40, I think it became official after the 46th season. And he was just this mastermind at promotions. He wanted to really, you know, a lot of people will talk about in Major League Baseball and really all sports, and even into the minor leagues, they'll talk about this concept of the fan experience. And he was really into that. But he was also a really smart baseball guy. And one of the things that he did, he not only did he integrate the American League, you know, it was on his watch that the Indians started looking to Mexico and Latin America for talent as well. Don't forget, at that point, the Indians signed Minnie Minoso. They signed Bobby Avila. They signed a lot of other players in markets that were not necessarily being tapped. But it was really funny because for all of his showmanship, he kept the funeral for the pennant under wraps. I mean, like, nobody knew that he was going to do this until the horse-drawn hearse came out at Cleveland Stadium with him with this casket. And the really funny part is they never found the pennant. They still don't know where it is. And there was always lore that, oh, maybe it was, you know, thrown out when they moved or you know, it's in somebody's, you know, it's in somebody's rec room now, but years later, they talked to the groundskeepers, and they said, oh, yeah, we had to, because they actually buried the pennant. I mean, they put it in a hole in the ground and put dirt over it. And the groundskeeper said, oh, yeah, we had to dig it up overnight because Bill Veeck borrowed the casket from a funeral home, and they wanted it back.
You have a chapter on the 1895 Cleveland Spiders, who were actually Cleveland's first championship team. You want to talk about them?
Yes, yes. The Spiders were a National League team, and in 1895 they won the Temple Cup, which is the postseason series. They finished second in the National League, but they played a series against there was a series between the first and second place teams, and the and the Spiders actually won that one. And, you know, unfortunately, there were a lot of factors at play, chief among them that there was no Sunday baseball in Cleveland. So Cleveland was regarded as maybe not an optimal market for baseball. So the owners of the team bought another team in St. Louis, the team that is now the St. Louis Cardinals, and essentially took everybody worth taking to that team and left, you know, the dregs behind. And the 1899 Cleveland Spiders went 20-134, which is the worst record in Major League history. And the most astonishing part about that to me is that 101 of those losses were on the road because nobody wanted to come to Cleveland because they said, we can't even recoup our travel expenses.
So they became a travel team.
Pretty much.
Dalen from Chelmsford, Massachusetts. What was the reason you guys let Dennis Eckersley go? I heard it was because Rick Manning was dating Eckersley's wife.
That is one of the stories that is told in the book, and that is I don't want to say that is the exact reason why, but it was definitely a factor. What happened was, and Eckersley had a very violent throwing motion. So there was also a thought that, you know, it was just a matter of time before he would have arm and elbow problems. And he did have arm and elbow problems, and that's kind of what led to him transitioning from being a starting pitcher to being the closer that he became. But at the same time, Manning, you know, Manning didn't have a whole lot of trade value because he was recovering from a back injury, and he ended up having a relationship and marrying Dennis Eckersley's former wife, who's Denise. I thought that was interesting. Dennis and Denise Eckersley, they had to deal one of them. And Eckersley is the one that they dealt, and Gabe Paul said later on, we traded the wrong guy.
Although Rick Manning has done a tremendous job all these years up till now as a TV broadcaster.
Yes, he is. He has been the television voice of the team for quite a long time.
Now, you have another chapter on what I think is one of the coolest teams in Cleveland history, the 1945 NFL champions, the Cleveland Rams. You want to talk about them?
Sure, yeah. Up until the Browns came along in 1946, Cleveland had a really hard time keeping a pro football team, which is kind of remarkable when you think about it, because the NFL was formed right down the road in Canton in 1920. So they had a couple of teams in the 1920s. And in the 1930s, the Rams came along. They played in the American Football League, not the same AFL that came along in the 60s, obviously. They played 1 year in that AFL. Were supposed to play in a championship, and their opponents went on strike because their paychecks were bouncing. And the Rams joined the NFL shortly after that. And they were kind of an also-ran in the NFL. The NFL in the 1940s was really ruled by the Bears and the Packers and to a lesser extent, the Redskins and the Giants. But in 1945, they really put it all together. Won their division. At that point, the NFL championship game rotated between the East and West Conference winners, and Cleveland was supposed to, the West Conference was hosting, so Cleveland ended up hosting that game. And the Rams played their home games that year at League Park. They opted to play the championship game at Cleveland Stadium on the lakefront, which is where the Brown Stadium is now. And they ended up winning by a point. It was a really interesting game because the margin of victory came from a safety. Sammy Baugh was back in the in his own end zone, and he threw a pass for the Redskins, and the pass hit the goalposts, which at that point were still on the goal line, bounced back into the end zone, and the rules at the time said that's a safety. The Redskins owners that off season were so mad and raised such hell about it that the rule was changed. So the Rams end up winning the championship, and then a month later they pack up and leave for Los Angeles.
I think it's one of the strangest things that for so long the goalposts were on the goal line, and it's like, mm-hmm. Why? And before somebody had the right idea, like, let's move them to the end, back of the end. Why? How could they be so? You know, I just can't imagine how that went, because it was going in, even into the, I don't know what the year, but I know into the 70s that was true.
Yeah, I don't have a good answer for you on that, but I mean, so much of what we, you know, take for granted now. In the NFL was developed through trial and error. And actually a lot of it, you know, some of it is even attributable to Paul Brown himself. He was actually the guy who said, we're going to start timing players in the 40-yard dash. And the reason for that was he said, you know, that's the amount of ground that we expect them to cover on a punt return. And, I mean, even today, if you watch the combine, that's everybody wants to know the 40 time.
Kenneth from Peoria, Arizona, small market baseball Cleveland is considered. Do you think they will ever have a chance to grab that World Series? It's been a long time.
Yes. Yes, it has. And I think they had a chance in 2016, and I think they had a chance in 1997, and it was just, I mean, they are the only team to lose two Game 7s in the World Series in extra innings. So, I mean, the chance is there. It's just, you know, I don't know if you want to call it bad luck or bad timing or anything like that, but, I mean, they just haven't quite put it together.
Tyler from Coral Gables, Florida. Wow, this show is so informative. Do you remember the spring training accident down here when Steve Olin got killed? Drunk and driving in the dark, they hit the dock.
I do. That was, in fact, I believe that was 30 years ago today. I know that they made some mention of it in local media. And I was, it was one of those things where it was kind of a confluence of factors. I mean, they had just returned to spring training in Florida from Arizona, and they were supposed to be in Homestead, and it got decimated by a hurricane, so they ended up in Winter Haven, and you know, that just happened to be a day off that they were all out doing their own thing, and Mike Hargrove, who was the manager of the Indians at the time, he says they've never he never scheduled a day off during spring training after that. It was just such a tragedy.
You have another good chapter of history on another forgotten Cleveland championship team, pro basketball, the 1961 Cleveland Pipers. You want to talk about them?
Yes, that was very notable. Pro basketball in the essentially into the 60s was kind of a fly-by-night league. The NBA came about because of the merger of the BAA and the NBL, and one of the leagues was formed because basically by managers of really big arenas because they needed something to put in there. And the other league was largely industrial teams because you had a lot of semi-pro teams that, you know, played basketball in the winter to kind of keep in shape. You know, a lot of steel mills had their own basketball team. A lot of auto plants had their own basketball teams. But there were lots and lots of competitive leagues that came up. And one of them was the American Basketball League. And Cleveland had a team, and it was owned by a young man who worked for his father's shipping company. And that guy was George Steinbrenner. And the team did well, and Steinbrenner had a lot of ambition to join the NBA. The deal ended up falling apart. The Pipers folded and, in fact, dragged the entire league with them to the point where Cleveland media said, this has essentially poisoned the well for pro basketball in Cleveland. Obviously, they were mistaken because it was less than a decade later that the Cavs came to town.
One of my favorite Cleveland Browns coaches is Sam Rutigliano. I'm intrigued by him because, well, he gave us that very special 1980 season, and you know, and he was charismatic, funny. And I think what's ironic is, you know, and of course the drug problem surfaced during his time, and he formed a group to try to help guys who had drug problems. And it seems like he was a very humane person. And I think that kind of led to the end of his career because the NFL isn't humane, you know, and pro football isn't humane. You want to talk about Sam Rutigliano?
No, you're right. It is. I mean, it is a meat grinder, and you know, Sam was one of those guys that, that he was. And, I mean, even today, you'll still see him on one of the post-game shows on Sunday nights. And he's still there, and he still seems like he's happy to be there, and he's very personable. And you know, he's one of those guys. And admittedly, it's not a high bar because, but, you know, Cleveland fans have really, you know, taken to him. And Cleveland fans will take to just about anybody that, that looks like they're trying to make an effort. I wrote a story about the Cleveland Barons, and I talked to Johnny Bauer, the late, great goalie. And he played for the Barons before he ended up in Toronto. And he said, I love Cleveland. I love being there. And the fans, you know, I was told early on, if you give it everything you've got, they're going to love you. And that's exactly what happened. And that's what happened with Sam Artigliano. And there is this great, I have very hazy memories of the Cardiac Kids, but, I mean, there is this love for this team that just really is kind of hard to explain. I mean, it's there were teams, I feel like the teams in the late 80s had more talent to them, but, you know, they just don't have that shine that the Cardiac Kids have and that Sam Artigliano has.
I'm glad you brought up Johnny Bauer and the Cleveland Barons, because there's a great book by Gene Kiechek called Forgotten Glory, how Cleveland's Cleveland
yes,
was and I see it. You know, back in the I was born in 60, became a super fan, Cleveland sports fan in the 70s, since 73, and I always, and people had such short memories. That's why I'm glad people are writing, when people write history books, because all I heard people say is like, oh, Indians haven't won a World Series since 1948, Browns have never been to the Super Bowl, and they didn't even know how, people really weren't aware of the Browns' eight championships, yeah, and then Cavs have never been to the finals, and then there's all this, the Barons winning all these hockey titles that were completely forgotten back in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, into the 60s. You want to talk about the Cleveland Barons?
Sure. I mean, that's, you know, we talked about how there was this idea that the Pipers had poisoned the well for pro basketball, and really until the Cavs came along, there was this idea that if Cleveland was going to get another major league team, it was probably going to be hockey. And it was probably going to be hockey because people went bonkers over the Barons. I mean, you know, old timers told me that there were games where, I mean, they were putting people in the aisles at the old arena. Everybody wanted to go. I was like the hottest ticket in town over the winter. And they were essentially a dynasty in their day in the AHL. The marketing campaign was that they were the seventh best team in pro hockey. At the time, there was only the original six in the NHL. For one reason or another, Cleveland was never able to get into the NHL till the late 70s when the Seals from California moved to Cleveland for two brief and very unfulfilling years as the Cleveland Barons. It was an unshirted disaster, and they remain the last team in any of the four major leagues to fold.
Our guest has been Mr. Vince Guerrieri, author of the 2022 book, Weird Moments in Cleveland Sports, Bottlegate, Bedbugs, and Bearing the Pennant, and more. We've got about less than 2 minutes. Let's see. You want to talk about the Beer Night Riot?
Yes. That's it's kind of funny because the Indians in the 70s were not great, so they did whatever they could to get people in to watch the games, and it was, they had 10-cent beer nights, and it was supposed to be the first of four, and it just, there were a lot of people who were there who were not there to watch the game, and in the bottom of the ninth, the Indians were on their way back when somebody jumped onto the field and tried to grab the Texas right fielder's cap. It was Jeff Burrows, and Jeff Burrows fell down, and Billy Martin said, they're attacking our guy, we got to go get him. And the Indians said, they're attacking one of the players, we have to help the Rangers go get him. And I actually got to talk to Ken Aspermonte, who was the manager of the Indians. I said, were you worried for your safety? And he says, no, no, I wasn't, because none of the people on the field that night were in any condition to really throw a punch. And the upshot is that the Indians ended up forfeiting that game, and everybody was kind of mortified by it.
Yeah, I was listening to it on the radio. I was like 14, and Herb Skor and Joe Tate were really upset because, you know, of the, because they were gone on the field quite a bit before they finally overran the field.
Yeah.
Again, we're out of time. Our guest has been the author of Weird Moments in Cleveland Sports, Bottlegate, Bedbugs, and Bearing the Pennant, and more. A book I highly recommend. Mr. Vince Guerrieri, do you have any final words for our audience tonight?
No, I think we're good. Go out and read the book. If you can't read the book, at least buy the book. They make great presents for Father's Day. Start your Christmas shopping ahead of time, and I hope you enjoy it.
Well, I enjoyed it, and I enjoyed our interview because it's a lot. Because I'm a historian, and I love history, and I love promoting history, and that's what your book has done here. So outstanding work, Mr. Vince Guerrieri.
Well, thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. Next week, we're going to have the starting center fielder and leadoff hitter for the coolest MLB team of all time, the Oakland A's from the early 1970s, Mr. Bill North, for the 19th time. Dear listener, may the road rise to meet you. May the wind be at your back. May the sun shine warm upon your face and rains fall soft upon your fields. And until we meet again, may God hold you in the palm of his hand. Good night, everybody. Thanks again, Mr. Vince Guerrieri.
Thank you.
Wonderful.